my God, thanks. And at such moments, I would kneel and press my forehead to the ground if my right knee would not begin to sob. Then I usually move to, I owe you big this time. I'll never ask for anything else. This time I mean it. It is easy to thank God for life when things are going well, but life is much bigger than we give it credit for, and much of the time is harder than we would like. It's a package deal, though. Sometimes our mouths sag open with exhaustion, and our souls and minds do too, with defeat. And that saggy opening is what we needed all along. Any opening leads to the chance of flow, which sometimes is the best we can hope for, and a minor miracle at that, open and fascinated instead of tense and scared and shut down. God, thank you. We and life are spectacularly flawed and complex. Often we do not get our way, which I hate, hate, hate. But in my saner moments, I remember that if we did, usually we would shortchange ourselves. Sometimes circumstances conspire to remind us or even let us glimpse how thin the membrane is between here and there, between birth and the grave, between the human and the divine. In wonder at the occasional direct experience of this, we say, thank you. I thank God when my obsessive looping is alleviated. Oh, God, thank you. 10 whole minutes just passed without one thought of a cigarette or a drink or the horrible ex. I got through the bad appointment with my doctor, my bank, my lawyer. The worst is over. Actually, under no circumstances should you ever say or even think that the worst is over. You will bring the evil eye down on yourself so fast it will leave you keening. But it is okay to say, that could have been so much worse, which is always the case. Gratitude runs the gamut, from shaking your head and saying, thanks, wow, I appreciate it so much, for your continued health, or a good day at work, or the first blooms of the daisies in the public park, to saying, thanks, that's a relief, when it's not the transmission, or an abscess, or an audit notice from the IRS. Thanks can be the recognition that you have been blessed mildly, or with a feeling as intense as despair at the miracle of having been spared. You say, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. My wife is going to live. We get to stay in this house. They found my son. He's in jail, but he's alive. We know where he is, and he's safe for the night. Things could have gone either way, but they came down on our side. It could have been much, much worse, and it wasn't. Heads, we won. And of course, gratitude can be for everything in between, from the daily break of good luck and found money, to the magical, mystical, magnetic force of quiet or exuberant relief, when you know that something, God, fate, luck, kismet, the law, Powerball, has smiled on you big time. Domestic pain can be searing, and it is usually what does us in. It's almost indigestible. Death, divorce, old age, drugs, brain-damaged children, violence, senility, unfaithfulness. Good luck with figuring it out. It unfolds, and you experience it. And it is so horrible and endless that you could almost give up a dozen times. But grace can be the experience of a second wind. When even though what you want is clarity and resolution, what you get is stamina and poignancy and the strength to hang on. Through the most ordinary things, books, for instance, or a postcard, or eyes, or hands, life is transformed. Hands that for decades reached out to hurt us, to drag us down, to control us, or to wave us away in dismissal, now reach for us differently. They become instruments of tenderness, buoyancy, exploration, hope. We sing a slow hymn at my church, St. Andrew's, that goes, God has smiled on me, He has set me free. For us to acknowledge that we have been set free from toxic dependency, from crippling obsession or guilt, that we have been graced with the ability finally to forgive someone is just plain astonishing. You can't have gotten from where you were, gripped by anxiety, tiny with fear, to come through to freedom for God's sake, to have been so lost that you felt abducted, to feeling found, returned, and set back on your feet. Oh my God, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thanks. A lot of us religious types go around saying thank you to God when we find a good parking space, or locate the house keys, or the wandering phone, or finally get a good night's sleep. And while that may be annoying to the people around us, it's important because if we are lucky, gratitude becomes a habit. You say thank you when something scary has happened in your beloved and screwed up family, and you all came through, or most of you did. And you have found love in the intergenerational ruins, maybe a lot of love, or maybe just enough. Or you can look at what was revealed in the latest mess, and you say, thanks for the revelation, because it shows you some truth you needed to know. And that can be so rare in our families, let alone in our culture, our world, and in our marriages, and in our relationships with our teenagers, and with ourselves. You say, thank you for lifting this corner of the curtain so I can see the truth, maybe for just a moment, but in a way that might change my life forever. And that moment is astonishing because everything is taking place all at once, the micro and the macro. You walk through the glittering city and gaze up at the heavens, and yet down here, you can see clearly what you have on your hands, or even what you have lost. Most of us figure out by a certain age, some of us later than others, that life unspools in cycles, some lovely, some painful, but in no predictable order. So you could have lovely, painful, and painful again, which I think we all agree is not at all fair. You don't have to like it, and you are always welcome to file a brief with the complaints department. But if you've been around for a while, you know that much of the time, if you are patient and are paying attention, you will see that God will restore what the locusts have taken away. I admit, sometimes this position of gratitude can be a bit of a stretch. So many bad things happen in each of our lives. Who knew? When my son Sam was 7 and discovered that he and I would probably not die at exactly the same moment, he began to weep and said, "If I had known that, I wouldn't have agreed to be born." This one truth, that the few people you adore will die, is plenty difficult to absorb. But on top of it, someone's brakes fail, or someone pulls the trigger, or snatches the kid, or someone deeply trusted succumbs to temptation, and everything falls apart. We are hurt beyond any reasonable chance of healing. We are haunted by our failures and mortality, and yet the world keeps on spinning, and in our grief, rage, and fear, a few people keep on loving us and showing up. It's all motion and status, change and stagnation. Awful stuff happens and beautiful stuff happens, and it's all part of the big picture. In the face of everything, we slowly come through. We manage to make new constructs and baskets to hold what remains and what has newly appeared. We come to know or reconnect with something rich and okay about ourselves. And at some point, we cast our eyes to the beautiful skies above all the crap we're wallowing in, and we whisper, "Thank you." When someone shares with you a horrible truth about the marriage that seemed fine, or work that seemed valuable, or a mind that turned out to be weaker than you thought, you say, "Thank you for the openness between us. That's the greatest gift." When someone you love can reframe something that was excruciating, having at last faced putting her husband in a home, or having watched her book or hopes or retirement accounts sink, and genuinely see something blessed in the mess, you say, "Thank you." You say, "Thank you that in the revelation, whether it's ordinary or difficult, this person you love has found a way to the balm of gratitude. What a relief." Revelation is not for the faint at heart. Some of us, with tiny paranoia issues, think that so much information and understanding is being withheld from us by colleagues, by family, by life, by God, knowledge that could save us and help us break the code and enable us to experience life with peace and amusement. But in our quieter moments, we remember that there are no codes, and if you are paying attention, plenty is being revealed. We are too often distracted by the need to burnish our surfaces, to look good so that other people won't know what screwed up messes we or our mate or kids or finances are. But if you gently help yourself back to the present moment, you see how life keeps stumbling along and how you may actually find your way through another ordinary or impossible day. Details are being revealed, and they will take you out of yourself, which is heaven, and you will have a story to tell, which is salvation, that again and again saves us. The way Jesus saves some people, or the way sobriety does. Stories to tell or hear, either way, it's medicine, the Word. So I say thanks, because revelation has shown me things that are miserable that somehow I may get to sidestep, or that are miserable but that prayer and friends help me find a way through, or that are painful and beautiful in ways that make your heart ache, that draw you closer forever to the comrades who have walked with you. Without revelation and reframing, life can seem like an endless desert of danger with scratchy sand in your shoes. And yet if we remember or are reminded to pay attention, we find so many sources of hidden water, so many bits and chips and washes of color in a weed or the gravel or a sunrise. There are so many ways to sweep the sand off our feet, so we say, "Oh my God, thanks." My pastor Veronica says that God always makes a way out of no way. This means that at some point, often against all odds, we will say, "Thanks." Now, Veronica is paid to have faith, but even I, who am not paid to have faith, know that this is true. I don't always believe it, but I know it is true. Recently, I was going to meet my great and amazing friends, Barbara and Susie, for a walk, or rather a stroll and roll, as Barbara has Lou Gehrig's disease. As I had pointed out to her, Lou Gehrig's is the one disease you are supposed to actively try to avoid, but she went ahead and got a full-blown case, which has come to mean she uses a walker, feeding tubes, and a computerized speaking device called Kate that works through her iPad. So Susie drove us to see the Pacific Ocean above San Francisco's Moraga steps. I had not yet settled down into what is true, that Barbara is pretty sick and getting worse, so I sat in a state of jovial nervousness in the back seat, feeling alone and useless and superficial. When we arrived, the view was sucked in with fog. We gamely got out of the car anyway, and on top of everything, the Lou Gehrig's, the Vishiswa fog, my anxious sorrow. There was one of those mean winds that prick at your body and your mind and your very being. Plus, they make your skin look terrible, just ghastly. It was all hopeless. I had no choice but to pray. This is all such a mess, I said to God. I love these two women so much, and I had had such high hopes for connection and joy today. Help. And I got my divine revelation. We all needed to get back into the car immediately. This took a while, as there is not much immediately when you're with someone who has ALS. But at some point, warmth and golden sun flooded through the car windows, and Susie drove us around the neighborhood. And from inside, we took in the brilliant gardens of succulents and crazy, bright, splashy, exotic petals. We found the one perfect parking spot at the foot of the steps where we could spend as much time as we liked looking up directly at the magical mosaic on the tall, steep steps. At the bottom, random plump fish in nursery colors swim against the deep blue of the sea, and then come creatures that are beneath the ground, spiraling to animals that walk on the earth, and then to what is above, to the sky and birds and clouds and an exuberant Mexican sun which curls up into the expansiveness of a starry, starry night. We all got so happy. We talked about real things for an hour. Life, death, families, feeding tubes, fate, faith. I asked Barbara, who does not eat food anymore, what are you most grateful for these days? She typed on her iPad, and Kate's mechanical voice spoke for her. The beauty of nature, the birds and flowers, the beauty of friends. This is called radical gratitude in the face of whatever life throws at you. I was so glad and so grateful to be there with them that day. Euphoric. Gratitude begins in our hearts and then dovetails into behavior. It almost always makes you willing to be of service, which is where the joy resides. It means you are willing to stop being such a jerk. When you are aware of all that has been given to you in your lifetime and in the past few days, it is hard not to be humbled and pleased to give back. Most humbling of all is to comprehend the life-saving gift that your pit crew of people has been for you, and all the experiences you have shared, the journeys together, the collaborations, births and deaths, divorces, rehab, and vacations, the solidarity you have shown one another. Every so often you realize that without all of them, your life would be barren and pathetic. It would be death of a salesman, though with email and texting. The marvel is only partly that somehow you lured them into your web 20 years ago, 40 years ago, and they totally stuck with you. The more astonishing thing is that these greatest of all possible people feel the same way about you. Horrible, grim, self-obsessed you. They say, or maybe I said, that a good marriage is one in which each spouse secretly thinks he or she got the better deal. And this is true, also, of our bosom friendships. You could almost flush with appreciation. What a great scam to have gotten people of such extreme quality and loyalty to think you are stuck with them. Oh, my God, thank you. The truth is that to whomever much is given, of him will be much required. And to whom much was entrusted, of him more will be asked, if Jesus is to be believed. He meant us, not the Kennedys or the Romneys, us, to whom such exquisite companions have been given. In the face of this, we mysteriously find ourselves willing to pick up litter in the street or let others go first in traffic, or even to let the psychotic talk to us for longer than a normal person would, to set aside the apprehension or boredom we feel and actually listen. Father Gregory Boyle, the Jesuit who founded Homeboy Industries, a program that helps former gang members re-enter society, reminds us that gratitude is not about waving your arms in praise on Christian TV shows. That's what we think God would want, because we would love to have a few hundred people applauding us, waving their arms like palm fronds. Instead, God's idea of a good time is to see us picking up litter. God must love to see us serving food at the soup kitchen at Glide Memorial Church, or hear us calling our meth head cousin just to check in because no one else in the family speaks to him. He can be long-winded and a handful, but we used to put each other's peas in the glasses of root beer at holiday dinners, so we have a history together. With two other cousins, we took naps together in one big bed, so we pick up the 200-pound phone, dial his number, and say, "How are you?" I really believe that God's idea of a good time is also to see us sharing what we have worked so hard to have, or to see us flirting with the old guy in line at the health food store, telling him our grandfather had a hat just like his, even though that is a lie. When you have been able to cry out, "Thank you," upon finding your lost child at the mall, or for getting off booze, it can naturally make you willing to take time with the homeless, although you are in a hurry and do not approve, and your rigid little right-wing friends have tried to convince you that the destitute are making more money than working people by standing in the intersection of Van Ness and Gary with their signs and cups and dirty children. Is it okay yet to love and admire Mother Teresa again? Can we forget her detractors for long enough to remember that most mornings she was out there on the streets of Calcutta cleaning some person's butt the day before he died without telling anyone about it? Thanks is a huge mind shift from thinking that God wants our happy chatter and a public demonstration and is deeply interested in our opinions of the people we hate to feeling quiet gratitude, humbly and amazingly, without shame at having been so blessed. You breathe in gratitude, and you breathe it out too. Once you learn how to do that, then you can bear someone who is unbearable. My general purpose go-to mystic Rumi said, "There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground, and hearing the barely bearable is one of the best." When we go from rashy and clenched to grateful, we sometimes get to note the experience of grace in knowing that we could not have gotten ourselves from where we were stuck in hate or self-righteousness or self-loathing, which are the same thing, to freedom. The movement of grace in our lives toward freedom is the mystery. So we simply say, "Thanks." Something had to open. Something had to give. And I don't have a clue how to get things to do that, but they did, or grace did. Thank you. Frequently, as so many poets and psalmists and songwriters have said, the invisible shift happens through the broken places. It might be through financial failure, or a divorce, or an emotional train wreck instead of winning the Nobel Prize, which I would prefer. This year's Nobel Prize in Humility goes to being at our least grateful, our pissiest, and most self-obsessed may create enough pain that we remember to do the footwork, get out of the house, or reach for the phone, or to get on our knees, or to get the hell outside. We ask for help. We call the horrible mentor or the sweetest confidant, or even our meth head cousin, who picks up and then can't talk. Thank you, Jesus. Because he thinks snakes have gotten into his car's dashboard, behind the radio, which is one of the occupational hazards of living in downtown San Francisco, all the radio snakes. And yet we get full credit for making the call. Having done the right thing lifts us out of the glop, the dregs of our own delusional thinking, and puts us a bit closer to being on the right track. Saying and meaning thanks leads to a crazy thought. What more can I give? We take the action first by giving, and then the insight follows that this fills us. Sin is not the adult bookstore on the corner. It is the hard heart, the lack of generosity, and all the isms, racism and sexism and so forth. But is there a crack where a ribbon of light might get in, might sneak past all the roadblocks and piles of stones, mental and emotional and cultural? We can't will ourselves to be more generous and accepting. Most of us are more like the townspeople of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery than we are like the Dalai Lama. I know I am. And this is what hell is like. It obviously behooves me to practice being receptive, open for the business of gratitude. A nun I know once told me she kept begging God to take her characteristic defects away from her. After years of this prayer, God finally got back to her. I'm not going to take anything away from you. You have given it, and you have to give it to me. I have found that I even have to pray for the willingness to give up the stuff I hate most about myself. I have to ask for help, and sometimes beg. That's the human condition. I just love my own guck so much. Help. Then I try to be a good person, a better person than I was yesterday or an hour ago. In general, the Ten Commandments are not a bad place to start, nor is the Golden Rule. We try not to lie so much or kill anyone that day. We do the footwork, which comes down mostly to paying attention and trying not to be such a jerk. We try not to feel and act so entitled. We let others go first. How can something so simple be so profound? Letting others go first, in traffic or in line at Starbucks, and even if no one cares or notices. Because for the most part, people won't care. They're late. They haven't heard back from their new boyfriend. Or they're fixated on the stock market, and they won't notice that you let them go ahead of you. They take it as their due. But you'll know, and it can change your whole day, which could be a way to change your whole life. There really is only today, although luckily that is also the eternal now, and maybe one person in the car, in the lane next to you, or in line at the bank, or at your kid's baseball game, will notice your casual generosity and will be touched, lifted, encouraged. In other words, slightly changed for the better, and later will let someone else go first. And this will be quantum. The movement of grace toward gratitude brings us from the package of self-obsessed madness to a spiritual awakening. Gratitude is peace. Maybe you won't always get from being a brat to noticing that it is an E.E. Cummings morning out the window, but some days you will. You go from being Doug or Wendy Weiner with your psychic diverticulitis, able to eat only macaroni and cheese, to remembering, I thank you, God, for most this amazing day. You splurge on a pint basket of figs or a pair of great socks. You begin to feel friendship with your flowering pear tree and interspecies oneness with it, although we usually keep these thoughts to ourselves, lest they be used against us at the commitment hearings. In fact, you are able to use the word wonder again, even feel it, without despair that the New York literati or your atheist friends will find out and send you into exile. This morning at 6, when I awoke, loneliness was sitting on my chest like a dental x-ray apron, even though I was buried in hairy dog love. I prayed, "Help, I am sad and lonely, and already it looks from here like today is going to be too long." So I did a kindness to myself, as I would have if a troubled friend had confided her loneliness to me. I heated up the milk for my coffee. Then I took the dogs for a short hike in the hills. My girl Lily is getting quite old, and while she is going to live forever, we have to go for shorter walks now. They are not manic Annie exercise walks anymore. About this, I am bitter. Where I burn off 300 calories and get to feel morally superior and eat more all day, they are half as long and slower, more amble than power walk, but of course they are lovely still. We hiked in the northern foothills of Mount Tamalpais, which lay stretched out above us, serene and curvaceous, sloping down to the sea. I could remember taking hikes up here with Sam and Lily when we first got here, a big rescue puppy encrusted with ticks. As she grew up, she'd still tear around for a while, but when she'd pause to stare nobly out at the vista like a dog in the movies, Lassie maybe, or Benji at his most Harrison Ford. Lily was limping when we arrived here today, more Amal and the night visitors than Lassie, and instead of a gentle warmth to soothe their joints, there was a wind, another damn wind. I hate wind so much, it can make you feel hopeless, even in world-class beauty. So I prayed, "Help me not be such an ass." This is actually the fourth great prayer, which perhaps we will address at another time. After a few minutes, I noticed something. Because of the wind, the view was free of particulates in the air and was so sharp and clear that it looked like one of those crisply bad paintings that are too true to life. After a few minutes, the wind had blown away, and much of my unhappiness, and it actually made me laugh, that our green fleecy hills, like torsos in repose, managed to look like a 19th century French painting. Wonderful. The scent of spring was as light as goodness, pure and natural, mixed with the smells of mulch and grass and the old lady perfume of wildflowers. This smell means baseball to me. I looked across the wooded canyon at Mount Tamalpais and shouted, "Thank you, Mother," and would not have cared if someone had come along and heard me. As it turned out, no one did, and I sat down with the dogs. The landscape was bare in the wind. A lot of birds were grounded. I sat in the dirt for so long that the dogs fell asleep on the warm carpet of earth. The next chapter is entitled Wow. The third great prayer, Wow, is often offered with a gasp, a sharp intake of breath, where we can't think of another way to capture the sight of shocking beauty or destruction, of a sudden unbidden insight or an unexpected flash of grace. Wow means we are not dulled to wonder. We click into being fully present when we're stunned into that gasp by the sight of a birth or images of the World Trade Center towers falling or the experience of being in a Ford at dawn for the first time. Wow is about having one's mind blown by the mesmerizing or the miraculous, the veins in a leaf, birdsong, volcanoes. Many people believe the word comes from the Scottish language. Robert Burns used it in a poem in 1791, Tam O'Shanter. And wow, Tam saw an unco sight. Unco means strange and unfamiliar, which you probably knew. You exclaim, wow, upon first testing halva And upon first hearing that the Scottish not only eat haggis, but love haggis, how is the child seeing the ocean for the first time? That is wow. Wow is the teenager's Christmas car, secondhand, but still. Wow is John Muir, Walt Whitman, Mary Oliver saying that the sun was the best preacher that ever was. The word wow is found in Child's collection of early ballads. But buy and ride the Black Douglas, and wow, but he was rough, for he pulled up the bonny briar and flanked in St. Mary's luck. I know that guy. We went out briefly, and I'm still getting over it. Any little thing would set off a new round of flanging. Some etymologists think wow is a contraction of I vow, the short form of Holy Glasgow, I vow. This theory sounds right to me. I remember hearing wow for the first time from the mouth of our most beloved family friend, a German nature lover named Gertrude. She said wow a lot when she and her husband took my family out onto San Francisco Bay on their small sailboat, and when we went on a wildflower hike in Yosemite. Wow, look at this. Looking straight up from beneath the Golden Gate Bridge. Wow, look at this. Alpine blue, spider lupine, monkey flowers, paintbrush. Wow, because you are almost speechless, but not quite. You can manage barely this one syllable. When we are stunned to the place beyond words, we're finally starting to get somewhere. It is so much more comfortable to think that we know what it all means, what to expect, and how it all hangs together. When we are stunned to the place beyond words, when an aspect of life takes us away from being able to chip away at something until it's down to a manageable size and then to file it nicely away, when all we can say in response is, wow, that's a prayer. Wows come in all shapes and sizes, like people. There are the lowercase wows. These are the times when we sink into something modest that delivers above and beyond. When you crawl between clean sheets after a hard day, you are saved. You feel like you are the best sandwich ever. You've been taken care of from the top and the bottom, with not a crumb or a lump or a wrinkle. Wow, you can't believe you feel so low and lonely till you thought to change the sheets. The cotton feels like cool, smooth skin. A lowercase wow might be seeing a kid execute a dive at the town pool, or coming upon a blanket of poppies in the field that was destroyed by grass fire last summer. And then there are the uppercase wows. Yosemite, fireworks, watching puppies being born at the neighbors when you were six. Remember first semi sort of being able to imagine the sheer size of dinosaurs at five or six, trying to comprehend how Brontosaurus could be 75 feet long, and what those feet must have looked like. As you studied dinosaurs in school, or in a book you took out from the library because you had to know more about them, you learned that they were doomed and that they died out. And you saw paintings of them with their dinosaur families, and you saw that they did wiggly, pouncy family stuff, the nicer ones nibbling on high leaves, like gigantic, lumpy giraffes, or like your grandfather taking a piece of turkey before Thanksgiving dinner. Then they were gone, kaput. When you're a little kid, that's about as trippy as science gets. These huge creatures once roamed the earth and now are fossils. Everything from stegosaurus to your granddad appears, roams the earth for a little while, and then vanishes. Wow. And let's not even get into the planets. That's when it all becomes terrifying for a decade or two. Not just that there are other planets, which is awful enough upon first hearing, but that there are also other suns. That just seems so wrong. What a nightmare. Not just a few other sons, but dozens of them. So this can't be. It's too much. Then it turns out that there are hundreds of other sons, and then thousands. You could have a nervous breakdown at 7 years old trying to take this in, and then again at 8 when you learn there are also 100 other universes. This is so terrible, worse than finding out that your parents have sex, or at least did those 3 times. And the only good news is that we somehow ended up on the one planet where someone thought up Monopoly and Oreos. By the time you discover that there are millions of other galaxies, you also discover boys, and then, even better, beer, Sylvia Plath, rock and roll. Things begin to look up. You may be able to give this joint a run for its money. This is when wow means phew. There are movies you never forget, whose scenes and music imprint themselves into your being. For me, it was Elvira Madigan, which I saw at 13 with my best friend in a shared 2-hour wow. People have said laughing things like, oh, it was basically like a shampoo commercial. And I say, aren't you great to try and correct my memories for me? I still love Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21. I'm sorry, sue me, I just do. The experience was so romantic and beautiful that it stunned and haunted me. God. When Sam was 6 or so, he explained to me why we call God, God. Because when you see something so great, you just go, God. I said, God, over and over when I went to New York for the first time. And when I saw a bay in Mexico carpeted with dolphins, I said, God, at my own house when a family friend, a man of 80, recited Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock one drunken evening with 20 old friends gathered around. That tableau is like a thumbprint on my heart. People tell you stories over the years of such astonishing mystery or perfidy that you never forget them. 10 or 15 years ago, my friend Neshama, who had just gotten back from Mexico, told me about one full moon night while she was there. In the town square was a bull ring with people drinking beer and being boisterous and incredibly loud, and bulls shuffling around in the dust, and music blaring and food pouring out from everywhere. 4 blocks away, in the front yard of a house, a family was trying to pull a big black tarp upright to create some privacy. But even with the tarp, you could see that in the yard were 100 wreaths and pots of flowers, hundreds of candles ablaze, and a wooden casket with somebody's body in it. People were milling around the yard and the coffin. Chairs were being set up, and the people were going to sit up with the deceased all night, being in the presence of the person and the body and the memories. I can perfectly remember the details in Ashama's face as she told the story, aghast at the bullfighting, aglow in describing the crummy yard, bright with candles and flowers, mostly marigolds, whose yellow petals symbolize the sun and light the path by which the departed soul finds its way back to the living. When all is said and done, spring is the main reason for wow. Spring is crazy, being all hope and beauty and glory. She is the resurrection. Spring is the Gerard Manley Hopkins. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. I read Hopkins for the first time in 7th grade, when I also first read Langston Hughes. And between the two of them, I was never the same. Poetry is the official palace language of wow. Buds opening and releasing, mud and cutting winds, bright green grass and blue skies, nests full of baby birds. All of these are deserving of wow, even though I've said elsewhere that spring is also about deer ticks, and everywhere you look, couples are falling in love, and the air is saturated with the scent of giddiness and doom. Petals are wafting and falling slowly through the air, and there is something so revel, languorous, reminding me to revel in the beauty of things wafting. And autumn ain't so shabby for wow, either. The colors are broccoli and flame and fox fur. The tang is apples, death, and wood smoke. The rot smells faintly of grapes, of fermentation, of one element being changed alchemically into another. And the air is moist, and you sleep under two down comforters in a cold room. The trails are not dusty anymore, and you get to wear your favorite sweaters. In spring, we expand and stretch in all directions. It's green exuberance and giddiness, bright clown colors and Easter colors too, the rebirth of the tender growing soul. In fall, we hunker down, pull the purse strings of ourselves tighter because it's getting darker and the storms are coming. Nature explodes in winter, and even more people die than in other seasons. The poor freeze and starve. It absolutely blows your mind how cruel nature and poverty can be. You almost have to turn away, and many people do. We see the brutality of life and nature, and also of what lives inside us. I don't like to see this. It does not work for me. We try to do our best, and then a whole snowy hillside buries 1,000 people. Life is eruptions, spasms, just as in our families. If you keep your heart open, these traumas beat you down. But against all odds, something emerges from the wreckage in our hearts so we can bear witness. Collect donations for the families or the town where the fire broke out, to childhoods destroyed by charming tyrants, to miners trapped 2,000 feet down. Love falls to earth, rises from the ground, pools around the afflicted. Love pulls people back to their feet. Bodies and souls are fed. Bones and lives heal. New blades of grass grow from charred soil. The sun rises. What can we say beyond wow? In the presence of glorious art, in music so magnificent that it can't have originated solely on this side of things. Wonder takes our breath away and makes room for new breath. That's why they call it breathtaking. We are individuals in time and space, who are often gravely lost, and then miraculously in art, found. In art, we feel the breath of the invisible, of the eternal, which Elie Wiesel described in Night as that time when questions and answer would become one. Wow, what horror that man saw, and what beauty, truth, and silence he still managed to create from it. In paintings, music, poetry, architecture, we feel the elusive energy that moves through us and the air and the ground all the time, that usually disperses and turns chaotic in our busyness and distractedness and moodiness. Artists channel it, corral it, make it visible to the rest of us. The best works of art are like semaphores of our experience, signaling what we didn't know was true but do now. In museums, when we behold framed greatness, genius embracing passion, obsession, discipline, and possibly madness, our mouths drop open. For a short time, we see past all that is jumbled, mysterious, marvelous, and ugly. Instead, we glimpse life, beauty, grief, or evil, love captured and truth held up to the light. Art makes it hard to ignore truth, but life explodes and blooms, consumes, rots and radiates and slithers, that eternity really is in a blade of grass. Jethro Tull sang that the same God who made kittens also made snakes in the grass. We stand before Monet and Rothko and the Sphinx and Georgia O'Keeffe and are speechless in awe. Awe is why we are here, and this state is the prayer. Wow! To watch one dance number by Fred Astaire or Pina Bausch is to see the sacred in communal energy. We see where everything comes from and where it all passes through, childbirth and death, the glorious, graceful, immediate, brutal, all that bad behavior. We see where everything is headed, more childbirth, more death, more bad behavior. We see in art a moment in time, an instant, and this is holy. Wow has a reverberation. Wow, 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 wow. And this pulse can soften us like the electrical massage an acupuncturist directs to your spine or cramped muscle, which feels like a staple gun, but good. The movement of grace from hard to soft, distracted to awake, mean to gentle again, is mysterious but essential. As a tiny little control freak, I want to understand the power of wow so I can organize and control it and up its rate and frequency. But I can't. I can only feel it and acknowledge that it is here once again. Wow. Even though I often remember my pastor saying that God always makes a way out of no way, periodically something awful happens, and I think that this time God has met her match. A child dies, or a young father is paralyzed. Nothing can possibly make things okay again. People and grace surround the critically injured person or the family. Time passes. It's beyond bad. It's actually a nightmare. But people don't bolt. And at some point, the first shoot of grass breaks through the sidewalk. The words wow and awe are the same height and width, all W's and short vowels. They could dance together. Even when, maybe especially when, we don't cooperate, this energy, the breath, the glory, the goodness of God is given. Gorgeous, amazing things come into our lives when we are paying attention. Mangoes, grandnieces, Bach, ponds. This happens more often when we have as little expectation as possible. If you say, well, that's pretty much what I thought I'd see, you are in trouble. At that point, you have to ask yourself why you are even here. And if I were you, I would pray, help. See earlier chapter. Astonishing material and revelation appear in our lives all the time. Let it be. Unto us so much is given. We just have to be open for business. Sometimes, oh, just once in a blue moon, I resist being receptive to God's generosity because I'm busy with a project and trying to manipulate him or her into helping me with it, or with getting my toys fixed, or any major discomfort to pass. But God is not a banker or a bean counter. God gives us even more, which is so subversive. God just gives to us, to you and me. I mean, look at us. Yikes. God keeps giving, forgiving, and inviting us back. My friend Tom says this is a scandal, and that God has no common sense. God doesn't say, I have had it this time. You have taken this course 4 times and you flunked again. What a joke. We get to keep starting over. Lives change, sometimes quickly, but sometimes, usually, slowly. Another thing to hate. I would much prefer a quick, dramatic change, as long as it was for the better. But unfortunately, a lot of us don't experience Pentecost. Tongues of fire appearing over our heads, blasting us into a new dimension. That would be great if I had a little heads up and if the timing was more convenient. If we stay where we are, where we're stuck, where we're comfortable and safe, we die there. We become like mushrooms living in the dark with poop up to our chins. If you want to know only what you already know, you're dying. You're saying, leave me alone. I don't mind this little rat hole. It's warm and dry. Really, it's fine. When nothing new can get in, that's death. When oxygen can't find a way in, you die. But new is scary, and new can be disappointing and confusing. We had this all figured out, and now we don't. New is life. If you are like me, you'd like to be able to understand and describe life better. Then you could manage and control it, and maybe realize a small profit or advantage. But that would be death. And when you see that you have mostly stopped trying to do this, and are instead trying to remember to step outside when you're buggy and to look up, you say, wow. You mindlessly go into a 7-Eleven to buy a large Hershey's bar with almonds, to shovel in, to go into a trance, to mood alter, but you remember the first prayer, help, because you so don't want the shame or the bloat. And out of nowhere in the store, a memory floats into your head of how much as a child you loved blackberries from the brambles at the McKegney's. So you do the wildest, craziest thing. You change your mind, walk across the street to the health food store, and buy a basket of blueberries and blackberries, because the answer to your prayer is to remember that you're not hungry for food. You're hungry for peace of mind, for a memory. That's all the time we have today for Inspiration and Religion. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been Lynn Segebrecht.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Military Times, followed by Sports Illustrated at 10. Starting Monday on the Noon Book Hour, we kick off our series of holiday books with Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot's Christmas. In Hercule Poirot's Christmas, the holidays are anything but merry when a family reunion is marred by murder, and the notoriously fastidious investigator is quickly on the case. Christmas Eve and the Lee family's reunion is shattered by a deafening crash of furniture and a high-pitched wailing scream. Upstairs, the tyrannical Simeon Lee lies dead in a pool of blood, his throat slashed. When Hercule Poirot offers to assist, he finds an atmosphere not of mourning, but of mutual suspicion. It seems everyone had their own reason to hate the old man. Hercule Poirot's Christmas by Agatha Christie, starting Monday at noon and Tuesday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 42 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 9 a.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, my name is Rob Johnson, and this is Military Times on this Thanksgiving Day, 2020, the 26th of November. Let's begin the story with a report from Your Navy magazine. At about 6:40 a.m. on December the 6th, 2019, Second Lieutenant Mohammed Saeed Al-Sharami, S-H-A-M-R-A-N-I, an international flight student from Saudi Arabia, entered the Naval Aviation School's command building on Naval Air Station, Pensacola, Florida. He had a Glock 45 9mm handgun and multiple extended capacity clips with him. 3 minutes later, the 21-year-old walked onto the quarterdeck and killed two sailors who were standing watch. For the next 9 minutes, Al Shamrani moved throughout the building, killing a third sailor and injuring five more military and civilian personnel. 12 minutes after he entered the building, security forces entered the quarterdeck and engaged him in a running gun battle in which a civilian cop was injured, this according to a Navy investigation into the mass shooting, which was released on Friday. Escambia County Sheriff's deputies arrived on the scene. Two of them were wounded as well. At 6:58 a.m., less than 20 minutes after he had entered the building, the carnage ended when another deputy shot him dead with a rifle. Ensign Joshua K. Watson, Airman Muhammad S. Hatim, H-A-I-T-H-A-M, and Airman Apprentice Cameron S. Walters were killed in the incident. Eight others were wounded. Al-Sharami was a radical, and this was noted in the FBI's investigation into the shooting released this spring, and the Navy probe lists that as the primary cause of the attack. Al-Sharami had repeatedly communicated with overseas Al-Qaeda operatives in the months leading up to the attack, and his social media contained ample evidence of him being a radical. An Al-Qaeda branch in Yemen released a video in February claiming responsibility for the attack. The Navy's investigation, led by Naval Air Force Atlantic Commander Rear Admiral John Meyer, states there were several indicators suggesting that the man was capable of doing this before the attack ever occurred. But such disparate indicators of potential trouble only became a web of interconnected red flags in hindsight after the man opened fire, according to the report. Military leaders, government employees, contracted employees, peers, and civilians knew of isolated events and indicators, but all remained unaware of the complete picture of the second lieutenant's potential threat indicators, Meyer added. Based upon the information available at the time, no one person or organization knew or could have known that Second Lieutenant Al-Sharani would attack active duty personnel, both members and civilians. The report lists several reasons why his path to being a radical was not recognized and interrupted. The junior officer had performed adequately while in the aviation pipeline, and he had no disciplinary or performance issues, according to the report. Keeping eyes on Al-Sharami was made even more challenging because he reported to five separate commands over an 18-month period as part of the International Military Student Program, which limited commander oversight. He was able to legally purchase the Glock he used in the shootings, but military and civilian leadership were unaware of the purchase. A civilian instructor with training ring number 6 saw Al-Sharami apply to purchase a gun that summer, according to the report. The chain of command was unaware of his radical social media post or that he had taken unauthorized travel in the United States before the incident. Al-Sharani had filed an equal opportunity complaint that the Navy closed 7 months before the attack, likely not to the satisfaction of him, the report states. The complaint was lodged in April 2019 against a civilian instructor who had called Al-Sharami porn stash, P-O-R-N-S-T-A-C-H-E. There was an adverse climate among international military students assigned to the NASC and harassment by a training wing 6 contract instructor. A Saudi superior responsible for good order and discipline had gone home a few months before the shooting, leaving a gapped billet, which may have played a part, as did isolated, questionable interactions with instructors and international military student officers, the report concluded. In addition, Second Lieutenant Al-Sharami likely faced additional personal and professional stressors due to a language barrier, cultural differences, and the rigor of high-risk aviation training and academics. Mitigating those individual risk factors may not have stopped the second lieutenant from evolving into a hostile insider threat, yet they may have lessened his cumulative load of stress, pressure, and anger. Still, the report notes that such stressors were not unique to him. In the absence of proactive leadership, positive command climates, and personalized risk management, they may also equally apply to every sailor and civilian on the base, the report adds. While Al-Sharami's social media accounts featured jihadist, anti-U.S., and anti-Israeli rhetoric, the report states that current technology is unable to effectively monitor such radical media. The factors that may have played a part in the shooting are being addressed by the Navy Security Coordination Board, a working group that is also handling uniform recommendations after a junior sailor killed two Pearl Harbor naval shipyard workers and himself in a December 2019 on-base incident. The board will make recommendations for how the Navy can improve security and response to active shooter situations. The Pentagon in January mandated enhanced screening, vetting, and monitoring of international military students, while also prohibiting them from buying guns or accessing bases on which they have no official duty. And now an article written by Sarah Sicard, S-I-C-A-R-D. She writes, "When I was a kid, my dad was deployed more times than I could count. While we corresponded through drawings, letters, and video greetings taped on VHS and sent back and forth between him and my mom, it was rare to be able to speak with him without help and costly USPS shipping fees, which were sure to break any kid's modest piggy bank. Being that it's 2020, however, military families have access to a number of communication methods that eliminate the need for snail mail, but that doesn't mean it makes missing a parent any easier. For a few kids whose identities are unknown, a doorbell became a lifeline to their deployed dad. The video was first shared by user USER at TRAVISAKERS, appears to show three children with a Ring video doorbell at their house, who stop by the front porch to ring the bell and record well wishes for their father and update him on the simple goings-on in their lives. Evidently, through the use of the system, he can access the recordings no matter where he's deployed. One of the boys shares that he wishes his dad would come home and waves as he steps off the porch saying, 'Bye, Daddy, I'm going to school, I'm going to learn a lot.' The other boy excitedly updates his dad about how he's learned to ride a bike without training wheels, shouting, 'All's I need for help is a push, and then I'm going by myself.' Most heart-wrenching is perhaps a little girl who leaves multiple messages wishing her dad would come home soon. 'Dada, I love you so much. Please come home soon. I love you,' she says. And military Twitter felt all the feels about the video, especially with today's holiday. And that concludes this particular article, but again, we want to wish you and yours a very safe and happy Thanksgiving. In our next article from the U.S. Army, the U.S. Army has made the consolidation of its Europe and Africa commands official, according to a November 20th statement. The new command will be called U.S. Army Europe and Africa, or by its acronym USAREUR-AF. All units assigned to U.S. Army Africa will be reassigned to USAREUR-AF. News of the consolidation and the elevation of the command to a 4-star billet had been out since early last month, and the statement offers little in the way of new details. It did, however, confirm that General Christopher Cavoli, C-A-V-O-L-I, who has received his 4th star, will command USAREUR-AF. U.S. Army Africa Southern European Task Force is now redesignated as U.S. Army Southern European Task Force Africa. The 2-star general in charge of the former USA Army Africa will serve as commander of the task force and also USAREUR-AF Deputy Commanding General for Africa. Major General Andrew Rolling, R-O-H-L-I-N-G, who is now the CETAF, S-E-T-A-F, AF Commander, and USAREUR-AF's Deputy Commander, served previously as the Deputy Commanding General of U.S. Army under Cavoli. This consolidation enhances global and regional readiness in support of the National Defense Strategy, Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy said in the statement. The new structure will increase command and control effectiveness, flexibility, and the capability to conduct large-scale joint and multi-domain operations. The new 4-star command will play a vital role in supporting missions across 2 interconnected theaters of operation, the statement continues. It was also enhancing efficiency by streamlining the headquarters' ability to execute functions and improve global and regional contingency response efforts. Another benefit to the consolidation is allowing the headquarters room to focus on strategic level tasks. SETAF-AF and the recently reactivated VIAS Invictor Corps will focus on readiness and interoperability with allies and partners at both the operational and tactical levels, the statement noted. V-Corps has a rotational forward headquarters in Poland and, according to the statement, will be integral to the planning and synchronization of operations in Europe. CTAF's AF will be responsible for army operations and assets both in Africa and Italy and will coordinate directly with U.S. Africa Command. U.S. Army Europe is based in Germany, and U.S. Army Africa was based in Italy. Based on the statement, it remains unclear whether there will be physical changes to either or both headquarters. Our next story comes to us from Washington. 6 locations have survived the first round of cuts and are still in consideration to become the new headquarters for U.S. Space Command, according to the Air Force. The 6 locations include 4 Air Force installations, the Kirtland KIRTLAND Air Force Base in New Mexico, the Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, the Patrick Air Force Base in Florida, and the Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado. Also under consideration, the Redstone Army Airfield in Alabama and Port San Antonio in Texas, which was home to the former Kelly Air Force Base and currently hosts Air National Guard and Reserve operations. Self-nominated communities from across 24 states were evaluated as potential locations for hosting the headquarters, according to the Air Force. The Department of the Air Force evaluated each location and now will conduct both virtual and on-site visits at each candidate location to assess which location is best suited to host the U.S. Space Command headquarters. This assessment will be based on factors related to mission, infrastructure capacity, community support, and the cost to the Department of Defense. At times, the competition among city has been politically contentious. A memo listing potential U.S. Space Command locations leaked to the press in 2019 included four bases in Colorado, the Buckley Air Force Base, the Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Base, the Peterson Air Base, the command's current but temporary home, and the Shriver Air Force Base, as well as Redstone Arsenal and Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. That raised the ire of Florida lawmakers who argued for the Air Force to reconsider bases in their home state. In March, Space Force Vice Commander Lieutenant General David Thompson told the House Armed Services Committee that he had been instructed to restart the competition, and the Air Force in May released new criteria for the headquarters location. The current candidate locations are more geographically distributed than those in the initial list, with only one Colorado base remaining in contention. Meanwhile, Vandenberg Air Force Base has dropped off the list of candidate locations, and it appears the Florida delegation was successful in raising the profile of one of its local bases. The new headquarters is expected to host 1,400 military and civilian personnel. Beyond that, new command will probably prove a draw for major space industry players and government contractors, all things that could benefit a region's economy and drive up the employment numbers. The Air Force plans on selecting a final Space Command headquarters location in early 2021. Until then, Peterson Air Force Base remains the interim headquarters. In our next story, a top Pentagon civilian has tested positive for COVID-19 after meeting with a foreign dignitary who may also have exposed Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller, as well as the top civilians from the Air Force, Navy, and Army, Defense News has learned. Lithuanian Defense Minister Ramadijus, last name Karbalis, K-A-R-O-B-L-I-S, met with Miller, the service secretaries, and retired Brigadier General Anthony Tata, T-A-T-A, who is performing the duties of the Undersecretary for Policy during a November 13th visit to the Pentagon. Upon returning home, he tested positive for the coronavirus. Miller, as well as Air Force Secretary Barbara Barrett, Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy, and Navy Secretary Kenneth Brathwaite, who met with the man November the 16th, have all tested negative and do not plan to self-isolate. The disease, which has claimed the lives of more than 250,000 Americans, has an incubation period of up to 14 days, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It is unclear where the Lithuanian defense minister contracted the disease and whether he was contagious during his visits to the Pentagon. Photos from the meeting between the two men, including defense leaders, show those in attendance all wearing face masks, although one formal photo shows two men standing without a face covering. In response to questions from Defense News about a possible infection, Chief Pentagon spokesman Jonathan Rath Hoffman said the department learned of the Lithuanian's positive test November 19th and then began testing. Tata tested positive twice and will be isolating at home for 14 days. We have and are continuing to conduct further contact tracing of DOD personnel who have had close contact with the Lithuanian delegation or Mr. Tata and are now taking appropriate precautions in accordance with CDC guidelines, Hoffman said. Additionally, DOD personnel who had contact with the delegation have received or are receiving at this time rapid COVID tests as deemed necessary based on CDC protocols. Additional necessary testing for individuals who had contact with Mr. Tata is ongoing. The military will provide no further updates unless it's deemed necessary. In our next story, a former Texas Army National Guard soldier and a federal program analyst have been sentenced to federal prison time in order to pay more than $2.4 million in restitution for military equipment they stole from Camp Mabry and sold on eBay. Crystal, C-R-I-S-T-A-L, Avila, A-V-I-L-A, 27, a former Guard soldier from Fort Worth, Texas, and her accomplice, U.S. Property and Fiscal Office Program Analyst, Joseph Mora, M-O-R-A, 36, pleaded guilty in August to stealing more than 50 items from the Guard facility over 3 years. A federal judge sentenced Avila to 2 years and Mora to 3 years in federal prison and ordered them to pay $2.4 million in restitution. They will also remain on supervised release for 3 years once they're out of prison. The items included thermal night vision devices, infrared aiming lasers, scopes, binoculars, and photography equipment, according to court documents. The thefts occurred in multiple incidents between December of 16 and September of 19, according to the court documents. In court documents, Avila said she was extremely remorseful for her crimes. She said she has no one to blame but herself for having sabotaged her chosen career. Mora managed to pull in more than $563,000 in selling these stolen goods. Though the stolen items were valued in the millions, she only received $34,400 for her role in the thefts. The sentencing of Mora and Avila sends a clear message to those who break the military oath of protecting this nation by stealing and selling military technology for profit, said San Antonio's special agent in charge, Shane Fulton, F-O-L-D-David-E-N. He's with Homeland Security. Scopes, infrared laser aiming equipment, and thermal night vision goggles are highly advanced technologies, giving our military a much-deserved edge on today's battlefield, he said. These schemes could potentially provide an opportunity for foreign adversaries to obtain sensitive U.S. equipment. The pair are far from the first to conduct a similar scheme. Former platoon sergeant Michael Barlow pleaded guilty to theft of government property and conspiracy. He testified at the 2017 trial of John Roberts of Clarksville, Tennessee, and Corey Wilson, who would find soldiers on Facebook selling military items, then ask for more expensive and harder-to-find items. That tactic eventually led to the theft, shipment, and sale of more than $1 million in weapons parts and sensitive military equipment stolen out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, that was then resold to buyers in Russia, China, Hong Kong, and the Ukraine. That conspiracy ran from 2013 to 16. Text messages between the soldiers and the civilians showed regular meetups to swap money for ballistic plates, helmets, scopes, and gun sights, according to Chief Warrant Officer 2, Sarah Perry, an agent with the Army Criminal Investigative Command who testified at the trial. One sergeant identified in court as E5 Rick, R-I-C-K, texted Roberts about going on hunting trips while on duty, which meant he was breaking into cars to steal equipment, Perry testified at the time. The Army identified about five surplus stores around Fort Campbell that were selling military equipment through backdoor deals. Wilson was sentenced to nearly 4 years in early 2018. Former soldiers Barlow, Kyle Heddy, and Jonathan Wolford all pleaded guilty and were sentenced to between 3 and 5 years each. More recently, Vermont National Guard Supply Sergeant Amon Yule, Y-U-L-E, 43, was sentenced in July to 3 years of supervised release and restitution. Ewell ordered equipment, including dozens of duffel bags, parkas, and boots from a military equipment distribution center in Kentucky to the Rutland Armory in Vermont between 2017 and 18, and then sold those items on eBay. In our next story, while the Trump administration may feel confident that Afghanistan is no longer a safe haven for al-Qaeda, experts who testified before the House Armed Services Committee on Friday warned that withdrawing troops without a peace agreement amounts to a gradual surrender and could lay the groundwork for terrorist networks to once again make a home in the country and plot against the U.S. The hearing, long scheduled, was notably absent of current Pentagon or White House officials, but came 3 days after Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller announced that the drawdown would proceed right past the 4,500 benchmark completed earlier this month and on down to 2,500 in January. The question came down to whether an Afghanistan withdrawal would in the short or long term lay the groundwork for another transnational terrorist attack on the U.S. The number of militant groups operating in some capacity in Afghanistan today, not just al-Qaeda, still persists. Seth Jones, who directs the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, told HASC Chairman Representative Adam Smith, a Democrat from Washington. "So what I can't say is, tomorrow things are going to get as bad as they say on 9/11, but I think the trajectory is where I really am concerned. And a small counter-terrorist force, whether it's 2,500 or lower, the experts say, would not be able to step in if the Afghan government falls to the Taliban, an event that would have a direct effect on the possibility of another attack on U.S. soil. The decision to continue with the drawdown brought into question whether the Taliban had met the conditions that Pentagon leaders had harped on for months, among them a commitment to rooting out al-Qaeda, its ongoing ally in Afghanistan, as well as a reduction in violence against U.S. troops. Previously, Pentagon officials had set 2,500 as a benchmark to be carried out only after reassessing the situation following the 4,500 level reached earlier this month. Former Defense Secretary Mark Esper had advocated for that pause, but after his ouster on November the 9th, the Trump administration forged ahead. Withdrawing troops gives away leverage in current peace talks, a former ambassador to Afghanistan added. These are surrender talks. We're waving the white flag, basically saying to the Taliban, you win, we lose. Let's dress this up the best way we can. Ryan Crocker, C-R-O-C-K-E-R, who served from 2011 to 2012, told the committee this in his prepared remarks. Another expert doubled down on the surrender theory, explaining that this partial drawdown, with no concessions made by the Taliban, is actually worse than pulling troops out of the country wholesale. I believe our interests are best served by no further withdrawals without a resettlement to end the war, Stephen Biddle, B-I-D-D-L-E, a senior Adjust ADJUST fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, said in his comments. By drawing down troops without demanding anything equally substantial from the Taliban, he said, the U.S. is giving away its leverage against them and is giving them exactly what they wanted all along, which is the American government getting out of their affairs. Why should they offer concessions when the U.S. keeps giving away what they want for free? If the withdrawal is an acknowledgement that a peace agreement isn't going to happen, he added, it would make more sense just to pull everyone out rather than waste resources and perpetuate the risk of keeping a 2,500-man counter-terror force on the ground. Though the Pentagon refused to get into specifics on Tuesday, lawmakers noted that the remaining troops will be largely counter-terrorist units of the sort that have been fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS within Afghanistan. That would mean thousands of train, advise, assist troops will be leaving behind unprepared Afghan security forces, as experts have agreed, including the Pentagon's own inspector general organizations, that while the Afghan government will ultimately be responsible for maintaining its own peace, its forces alone are not operationally capable of beating back a resurgent Taliban. The administration's plan has received mixed derision and support from lawmakers, with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, warning against a rapid withdrawal, while Smith has come out in support of the incremental drawdown to 2,500. It seems like the common sense thing to do is to have the absolute minimum presence that we require to meet our goal of stopping that transnational terrorist threat, Smith said, suggesting a more modest U.S. approach to contain the threat, akin to the ones in Libya, Yemen, or Somalia. Smith's comments left some room to veer off of the current Trump administration course, which is to complete a total withdrawal by May. The incoming administration under Joe Biden has not made a statement on whether he will choose a different roadmap. I happen to believe that we need to draw down there because of the cost, because of the impact, and because of the fact that it has become clear that we're not going to be able to impose peace upon Afghanistan, he added. In the 19 years since the original invasion, more than 2,400 American troops have died, nearly 21,000 have been injured, and nearly $1 trillion has been spent on trying to make Afghanistan stable enough to keep terrorist networks from running rampant throughout the country. Further, Smith supposed the situation in Afghanistan will continue to be unstable, but the only question for lawmakers is whether U.S. presence has any real effect on that, and if the U.S. can live with the consequences of leaving them to their own devices. Lives are still being lost, money is still being spent, our troops and others are still being forced to be sent over there, and the American people are saying, why are we doing this, Smith said. And if the answer is we just have to hang in there for another year or two, gosh, if we just send another 5,000 troops, we'll get to a peace deal. I don't think anyone anymore believes that, not in a serious way. What does happen if we pull out? Just a slightly different flavor of chaos in the minds of most people. And should the Taliban attempt to take over Afghanistan and again create a safe haven for their terrorist groups, would the U.S. be able to respond with a 2,500 counter-terrorist troop force in the country? It's a mistake to separate counterterrorism and the survival of the Afghan government, Biddle said. If the Afghan government falls and the Taliban takes over, or there's simply a chaotic civil war, the terror threat from Afghanistan will go substantially up, and the ability of a handful of American troops operating from a handful of bases is very, very limited. In our next story from Washington, an annual defense policy measure that has passed Congress every year since the Kennedy administration is in danger of cratering next month over a move by the Democrats to rename all the military bases, including Fort Benning, any base named after a Confederate officer. The president, Donald Trump, opposes renaming the bases, including Fort Hood, and has threatened to veto the popular measure over the Democrats' provision, which was added to both the House and Senate versions of the so-called Defense Authorization Bill over the summer. Republicans are vowing they will not send the broader bill to Trump if it includes language requiring bases named after Confederate officers to be renamed. Trump used the debate this summer to appeal to Southern voters nostalgic about the Confederacy, and those appeals remain relevant now due to two Senate runoff elections in Georgia that will determine control of the chamber during the first 2 years of Joe Biden's tenure. I am concerned that there is at least the potential that political concerns, especially with the Georgia runoffs, are going to play the bigger role, said top House Armed Services Committee Republican Mac Thornberry of Texas. I have no doubt that we can reach an agreement. The question is whether the politics above us will allow us to. Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman James Inhofe, a Republican from Oklahoma, is strongly backing Trump, aides involved in the talks say. But Democrats who won GOP support in both the House and Senate to force the renaming of the bases vow they will not back down. Typically, both when the House and Senate versions of legislation contain comparable provisions, the default position is to leave the language in the final product. The differences between the House and Senate provisions are relatively modest. It's the Senate language that we want to agree to, said House Armed Services Committee Chairman Adam Smith, a Democrat from Washington. So there shouldn't be any controversy here. He called President Trump a little bit erratic at the moment. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, another Democrat from California, says the names must be changed. It is imperative that the conference report include provisions that secure this essential priority, said Pelosi. Our bases should reflect our highest ideals as Americans. The bill has to pass next month to avoid breaking a 59-year streak of enacting the annual measure, which sets policy across the Pentagon and would award the military a 3% pay raise starting January 1st, among its many provisions. Look, the defense bill is really important, Smith said, expressing hope that the Republicans would relent. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows has even floated the idea of a trade-off in which Trump would sign the legislation containing the Democratic language in exchange for repealing so-called Section 230, a legal shield for liberal social media outlets, including Facebook and Twitter, that protects websites from liability for content posted on their sites. The New York Times first reported Meadows' attempt at deal-making, which was confirmed by a Democratic aide who requested anonymity because they were not allowed to comment on the issue. Both the House and Senate defense measures pass by veto-proof margins, but GOP leaders want to avoid the chances of a veto coming to pass. Either way, the issue seems to be a loser for Georgia's Republican senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. Breaking with Trump to override the veto could mean a loss in support among core GOP voters, while standing in favor of keeping the base names could drain support from the independents and the Democrats. And now medical news from the Military Times. Many military families are evaluating whether they're going to pay for TRICARE young adult coverage for their children up to age 26, given the cost increase coming in January. Monthly premiums will increase by 22% to $459 for those in TRICARE Young Adult Prime and by 12% to $257 for those in TRICARE Young Adult Select. One wife of a medically retired service member said two of their three children are in college and one will turn 23 shortly, which means they will have to buy TRICARE young adult coverage in order for their daughter to continue to be covered under TRICARE. Since I am disabled too and cannot work anymore, it will be very hard on us. I can imagine that the ridiculous high rate is hard on most military families, she told Military Times. By law, the TRICARE young adult programs must be at no cost to the government under the rules set when it was implemented in 2013. So the full cost of the program's premiums is reflected in the fees charged to the families. Defense officials look at the health care expenditures for the program for the previous year and calculate the cost. Military families purchase the TRICARE Young Adult Insurance because they plan to use it, said Mark Ellis, Chief of Policy and Programs for the TRICARE Health Plan. Officials see a higher utilization of outpatient visits, inpatient hospitalization, and particularly pharmacy benefits in the TRICARE Young Adult population, he said. A small number of enrollees make up a large chunk of the benefits being used, Ellis added. For example, in the previous year, 7 TRICARE young adult prime enrollees accounted for 40% of the overall pharmacy cost, Ellis said. That's 7 people in a population of 10,509 adult children enrolled in TYA Prime. Likely, those patients have some sort of medical condition, typically